Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 16th, 1996. In the fireside room this evening, we will be listening in on a theme forum. Tonight's topic, is imagination required to be a child of God? Let's listen in.
Welcome to tonight's forum, and thank you all for coming. My name is Chris Sharon, and I help coordinate the teaching staff and the program here at Holden. And a part of that job is helping to organize and facilitate forums. And we have a wonderful group of artists and musicians in the village this week, as the Vespers tonight showed, dancers and storytellers and singers. And last night at Vespers, we had an experience to hear poetry and worship. And so we thought, what a great week to explore the question of imagination in our life as baptized people. And so this question, is imagination required to be a child of God, is of course kind of a joke to raise the question.
I was confused.
It's not required. However, the interesting thing is, what do we do with the creativity and imagination as Christians, and how does it help us? And so I asked a couple of different artists or people who reflect on imagination and live that out to help get us started in our conversation about this topic. And in Holden tradition, we'll hear from each one of them, reflect on their lives and their experience with the subject, and then when they're done, we'll just have a group discussion about it. And I try to encourage everyone to talk, so if you'll just raise your hand or make sure that no one else is talking before you start, and we'll try and hear from people who haven't spoken as we move along in the discussion. If no one else wants to say anything and you've spoken already, then feel free to jump in again. I wanted to give a brief introduction to the relationship between baptism and this imagination idea from my perspective, because in part I was behind coming up with this idea. The summer theme, as many of you know, is water washed, spirit born. And that's a way for us to poetically speak about baptism. And although many of us at the village aren't Lutheran, the village has Lutheran roots, and Luther in particular loved baptism and spoke about it very highly. And I thought one particular provocative thing that he said about baptism might get us into a framework to think about baptism and why imagination might matter. And this brief quote is from his reflections on baptism in the Large Catechism. He's reflecting on baptism, and he's just gone through his discussion of what he thinks baptism is. So he says, "Therefore, baptism is far more glorious than anything else God has commanded and ordained. In short, it is so full of comfort and grace that heaven and earth cannot comprehend it. It takes special understanding to believe this, for it is not the treasure that is lacking. Rather, what is lacking is that it should be grasped and held firmly. In baptism, therefore, every Christian has enough to study and to practice all of her or his life." So with that sense of baptism, that it's not just an event that happens once where water is poured on us, either on our head or all over our body, but it's something that we live daily, and that it's such a glorious and wonderful and all-consuming thing. In a sense, that's our identity as children of God, that it is something that heaven and earth cannot completely comprehend. So with Brother Luther giving us that kind of a sense of baptism, I think that it's important that we have some imagination and creativity as we think about living as baptized people. So I've asked each person on the panel just to reflect from their own experience and their own sense of creativity and art, how they engage the Spirit and how they engage their sense of creativity in their life of faith. And they can talk about it however they want. And I hope that that will draw each of us out in the ways that we do that. And you can each introduce yourself as you begin. And it doesn't really matter if we go in order or not. but we could.
In fact, we probably will.
Okay.
If that's okay.
Well, all right.
Excellent.
My name is Rebecca Wee, and I am teaching creative writing, poetry in particular, some composition and literature at Augustana College. And this is not what I thought I would be doing. I don't know that I ever thought what I would be doing. The thing I remember loving to do most and earliest was drawing. And I went to a school where the art cart came to our room. It felt like once a month, you know, for 20 minutes we got to play with clay or finger paint or something. And so I remember early on being moved by drawing and the outdoors. And when I teach now students poetry, I get a lot of students, college students, who come and say, I don't like poetry, I'm taking this class because I have to, I don't understand it, I don't like it, I don't write it. And it's amazing to me how often, within a few weeks, they're quite interested in it and they are writing it. And so I've been sort of interested in why that is so. And my sense is that often, as younger kids, in school you get taught sort of the mechanics of something first, and people get bored, or they tried to interpret a poem and got told that's not what it meant, and they panicked and never tried again. And that it's actually a really enriching experience for them to find that they can use language to express feelings, emotion, taste, sight, sound. And I suppose that that's why I have been interested in it. I don't know if this is the right place to confess, but I've always felt more at home barefoot and outside than dressed up and showered and in church, I suppose. I feel more true to myself and to my sense of what the spiritual is. And in parallel, I suppose, school, I felt more at home in a messy room full of pottery and clay and paint than I did even in the silence of the library. But I see my own writing now as both a vehicle and a result of a kind of spiritual questing or pilgrimage to try to understand why I'm here, why any of us are here, how to come to terms with the disaster and trauma of our times. And I guess the poems that I read last night, which I chose, were all really rooted in the earth and in air and in feeling and in sensory experience. And that's where I feel most alive. And I don't know that I have more, by way of introduction, I guess that's why I teach it. I didn't expect to teach it, but I have a father who teaches English and a mother who's a poet, and I became both of them without meaning to. So it maybe it's genetic more than anything else. But so.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. We should have drawn numbers.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm Roxanne Grinstead, and going back to my childhood, there's a lot of correlations. We haven't spoken before together at all, so this is a real surprise. But I was always outdoors, and I was always drawing or dancing or painting or imagining things. I had my own world constantly. Whenever I was by myself, I was making up all sorts of things. And through my life, I found that I'm happiest if I'm creating something. And the end product, is, once I'm done with it, I just leave it. It's done, and then the next thing is what I'm thinking of. And when I was younger, I couldn't imagine that I could ever fit into the church, because I was disorganized and creative and dancing around, and I didn't seem to fit at all. And when I was in my teen years, I kind of struggled with that a little bit. And I came to Holden Village, and there was Mary Schramm, and with her book about gifts of grace. And I read that, and I thought, wow! This is really exciting to think that maybe I was meant to be this way. I'm not just a misfit or a totally worthless person, because it seems so peripheral that I was always excited about all this creativity. Then the thought struck me that, hey, God is the most creative being around. Think of the earth. And I thought, wow, he probably started with an ordinary bird and then thought, we're going to have to stretch the neck out a little. We got a duck. Isn't this exciting? You know, whoa, how about a little longer neck? We have these snow geese. And then the ultimate, let's go a step further. We have a swan. Wow. God is constantly creating. Think every human being is different. I mean, I create a lot of works of art and they're all different. Or liturgical dances are all different. But imagine every human ever born is different. Now that's creativity. Wow. So then I thought, well, maybe it's okay to be who I am. But I still struggle, you know. I still go back and insecurity gets to me when I think that maybe what I'm doing is not that important. And then I began to study for my master's and found that recent studies have shown that if you add the creative element to any kind of learning, it becomes more effective. If you take two identical curriculums, you put creative things in one and just book learning in the other, the group over here learns faster, learns better. So then creativity became kind of a subject of real importance for me, of maybe kind of the glue that holds everything together, or makes things happen, or makes things meaningful for us. And the creative process, if you're involved in it, then it becomes deeply meaningful for you.
Thank you. Yeah. Preach, sister.
Yeah. Oh. I don't know where that came from. I had no idea what I was going to say when I sat down.
Yeah, you were channeling the great creator. Okay. I'm Linda Breitag, and the thing I used to love best as a child was drawing. So there you go. And I actually lost the H encyclopedia out of our set because I took it on vacation because I wanted to draw the horses. So. Anyway, that's what I used to do. But I guess it's the same thing. I've always liked music and drawing and, you know, dancing and especially a lot of crafts. I went through every phase possible, macrame to, you know, quilting to the whole bit. And I have to say that, I mean, when I think of this question, it really confused me, but I was relieved that it confused everybody. And I guess the way I look at it, as a person that, you know, both tries to live a life with creativity as kind of the main structuring principle, which I think for me anyway is a big struggle, and I've seen for a lot of other people it's a big struggle in a lot of different ways. You know, at the end, I mean, at the extreme, it's, you know, how could you make a living doing it? But right at the beginning, it's, do I have the right? Yeah. And I think that's a really huge thing that people struggle with, including people who make their living doing art. And so when I see that, is imagination required? I think that, I mean, I hate to say this almost, because people always say, oh, everybody's creative, you know, and then, you know, there's people that go, yeah, right. You know, or sometimes there's even teachers saying, well, what about these three students, you know? But I really believe that everybody does have imagination and creativity, and that it's like Roxanne said, there are so many millions of ways to be creative. And so that's one thing, is that, you know, looking for it and kind of saying, well, creativity is, you know, art and music and, you know, poetry and things like that, and not engineering or problem solving or nursing or whatever. That's one problem. And I think another problem is the it's just basically willingness. The main thing that's necessary in art is willingness to look like a fool, to risk, to get out of the way, you know, your own your own, I can't do it, I'm not good enough, what if it's not, nah, 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 you know, that whole thing. I think that, anyway, that's kind of what I've come to in the last few years, is that if we could just be more willing. I think about the great artists, or the ones that we know about anyway. I'm sure there are many millions of great artists that nobody ever hears about except for in their own communities, especially women in the past, I think. But when you think about the artists that really changed things, they really took a big risk. And a lot of them were called fools and naive and idiots and, you know,
insane.
You know, you think about people who are now very famous that, you know, were unknown or reviled during their lifetime. And so you come back to really, do you want to do it or don't you want to do it? Because if it's because of what you think people will think of you after you do it, it's not going to work. And I've really struggled with that because I was brought up to really want approval. And so I really struggle with that, you know, doing what I really want versus doing what I think will get me some kind of, you know. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know where that came from either. So, take it away, Chris.
Sure. Do you want to say anything about the recent stuff that you're doing, like Interplay?
Oh, yeah.
Just to give people a sense of how you're trying to bring that together.
Yeah. What I came here to do, or one thing I came here to do, was to teach a class. And I can't do it because of some physical problems. But I've been studying for about a year and a half now this approach, I guess you'd call it, called Interplay. And it's some people in the San Francisco, the Bay Area. They're dancers and spiritual leaders. One woman is a congregational minister, and the man is a Methodist, or he grew up Methodist, but he's a lay minister, and they're both dancers. And through their experimentation with a lot of choreography and planning ahead and doing big projects and things like that, they've realized that for them, the best thing that works, that makes them feel the most connected to that creative flow from God, is the spontaneous and the improvisatory. So both in their own work and in what they teach. And that's, I guess, speaking for myself, what draws me to their work is that both I need what they have to teach me, and also I want to pass on what they have to teach me, because there's several ideas, you know, principles, well, many, that they have, but some of the major ones are that the body and the mind and the spirit are completely one, and they're inseparable. And so to take little pieces out and say, well, I do this with my body, and this, you know, completely, you know, countervents, or what's the word?
Fractures. Well,
fractures our lives, basically, and makes us miserable. And that the most important thing for people is to have some access to their creativity and not leave it up to the experts. And that doesn't mean there isn't a place for experts and professional artists, but that so many people these days are so willing to pay a lot of money to watch. And that's great, but part of the drive, you know, that you see when you watch Michael Jordan play basketball, or when you watch ballet, or you watch Alvin Ailey, or you hear Maya Angelou, or, you know, all those, the part of that yearning is what you have inside. It's not just that you hear something beautiful, it's a yearning, I believe. And so what these people, Phil Porter and Cynthia Winton Henry, have been building is a way to teach, or a way to basically let people free their own creativity in the moment. So instead of saying, okay, let's, you know, do an 8-week class, and at the end we're going to have a big production and you're going to have to get up in front of your parents and do this. It's, you know, let's tell a 3-minute story and then let's just forget it. And so there's none of that, well, was that good? It's just kind of like, well, how did that feel? Or what did you notice? And so they've got people who have never danced, or who maybe have severe back problems, doing movement just to please themselves, maybe with their eyes closed, maybe lying on their back to music. And it's just, I've seen some really amazing things happen through this work. So anyway, that's just a beginning.
You're talking about process rather than product, and I suppose that's part of what's so... We live in a culture that values product and, you know, what you end up with rather than the journey. And so you spend a lot of time feeling sort of guilty if you're on the journey and you're not sure where you're headed or where you're going to end up. And there's the risk. And that is exactly what I think most people who engage in some sort of art will say is where you get your sense of fulfillment or being alive is exactly that risk. And I think... for poetry, because it's hard to read, it requires a kind of focus that's different than reading the newspaper. It's not a sound bite, you know, it's dense. It requires a kind of attention and contemplative time and space that we don't get much of. Everything is very fast. I mean, things are moving fast. You've got a lot of things to do in a day. You've got a long list of things to do. And poetry, for me, forces a slowing down both to write it and to read it. And that's the same thing I suppose my spiritual life or prayer requires of me, is a kind of silence, I suppose, as much as anything, that's very hard to find. So now I've talked twice. So sorry. And now.
So we'd like to just open it up to stories or comments or questions that anyone might have that either come out of what's been said already or have nothing to do with it, but are of interest to you and what you bring.
Like I said, the one thing that came to mind for me, and I have two left feet, and I can't draw over beams and stuff like that, but...
None.
Yeah.
But I do get much joy out of my work, which is actually my play, and that's designing houses and building them. Mm-hmm. And I think when you're doing something that's creative, or whatever form, like engineering or bookkeeping or whatever, so things that you enjoy, it's a lot easier to relate to God and be more Christ-like than when you're struggling to make the house payments and picking up the kids on time and all those things kind of fill up your day and producing nothing to really express yourself.
Yeah. And you're right that it's so many different. For some people, it's gardening or cooking or, you know, what is one person's trauma really is somebody else's way of doing art. And I think, you know, building a house, what a wonderful way to create and watch something that you made.
There was a book, and the name was Flow.
Oh, yeah, I've read that.
And can you pronounce the author's name?
No, it's like Chizumenska-Hawley or
something. Yeah. But he's quantified his happiness. Mm-hmm. And it really is getting in and doing what you feel good at. Mm-hmm.
And he relates that to experiences of wholeness or of well-being or of... for religious people, an experience of God or the Spirit. And do you experience that when you're building houses and stuff?
Oh, yeah. Time
goes away.
Speeds up or slows down again.
Yeah, exactly.
It totally twists the reality.
But you know what you just said before about how it's so much easier to do it when you're doing that thing that you can flow with than it is when you're, you know, paying the bills or getting your kids off to school or whatever. And Ray and I were just talking about this today. How can we have more time in our lives, or at least a time, even 20 minutes a day, where you sit down and say, okay, this 20 minutes is sacred and I'm going to do something that renews me? Because it's just so easy to get busy and flip through your life and keep thinking, someday I'd like to write a poem, or someday I'd like to draw, or someday I'd, you know. And that's a big discipline, I think. And it's a spiritual discipline.
It is.
It's really hard, I think, for me.
Other, please.
Well, considering living baptized as being my occupation, I was thinking of the word openness, but when you said willingness of an artist to be a fool, to take risks, to me that describes a Christian. In order to live as a child of God, I have to be willing to be made foolish.
Yep.
Have to learn to fail and not be embarrassed about it, because I really didn't fail after all. That's just the judgment of people around me. I don't have to judge myself as failing. But the whole idea of moving through, too, that we're talking about artists and dancers, hip spirit, in order to live baptized, you have to be open. You have to be willing. If you're closed and set and, you know, have your day timer filled out at exactly every minute of your day, and I don't go for this stuff and scheduling 20 minutes of being creative. You know, you've got to have more flow than that. You have to live baptized when you're doing all those things you hate, too.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Not that's just the things you like, because we don't get to do only the things we want to do in our lives.
I think you're right about the openness to, you know, whatever moment comes on you. I think, though, that the discipline for whatever it is that your art is, for some people, I mean, I find that it, for me to say I have to write every day for an hour, chances are that's not when I'm inspired, but I have to clear an hour every day the same way I would have to stretch out before I go running so that I can have the day where I run really well, or I have to do the scales on the musical instrument and it sounds like trash for, you know, a year before I finally play the thing well. So I have ended up needing to work the discipline part, which does not cancel out also being open to, in the middle of a day where you've got something
Jesus
else planned.
Jesus wants us to be disciplined. He wants us to obey him. Mm-hmm. He says be open, and to obey him we have to be open.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, they sound like they may be antithetical, but they're
right.
not.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with having an idea of what you want to do during the day,
mm-hmm.
but you have to be open
to change directions
or to what happens now, and not say, I'm sorry, I can't be open now, I have to go do this.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is a hard thing to do if you think about how our days are structured.
But I'd like to add, there are times when you do have to do that, and I think especially women are programmed to never be able to say, no, I'm sorry, just right now I have to go write, or something, you know? So I know just what you're saying, but I'm also putting in a little plug for sometimes, I think, especially if the things that you're doing that come from other people's demands that you don't feel like, what Mary Schramm always used to say is, or still does, said it 2 days ago to me, if it doesn't give you energy, don't do it. You know, someone will do it. And if it doesn't get done, then it's not meant to be done. And if people see that it's not done and it bothers them enough, they'll do it. You know, it's just that kind of feeling of, you have to have an allegiance to the thing that you know God is drawing you to do. So it's a real hard line, I think, to walk.
Well, I think we're drawing lines here, whereas, you know, there are many cultures where art isn't a part of everyday life.
No, that's true.
The Japanese wrap every single package that you buy at the store as though it were a Christmas present.
Yeah. You know, that's true.
They don't just throw it in a bag and out the door.
Yeah.
That's, to me, what art is living baptized, living creatively, and doing everything that you do as though, you know, not take 4 hours to do it, but everything well. And concentrate on what you're doing at the time, and then move on to the next thing. And as Americans, we try to listen to the radio, we try to, you know, do our aerobics while we're doing our studying and fixing dinner. You know, I mean, that's ridiculous. You know, we're not concentrating on anything there.
Right.
Yeah.
Other people who want to jump in?
Last Friday, in one of the classes here, I picked up a sentence which helped me to focus how I want to spend these last few years of my life. Thomas Merton was quoted as saying, all that you and I can ever hope for in terms of visible results is that we will have perhaps contributed something to a clarification of Christian truth in this society. And as a result, a few people may have got straight about some things and opened up to the grace of God and made some sense out of their lives, helping a few more to do the same. Huh. And my question is, use your imagination. How can any of us help to clarify Christian truth in this society?
Yeah. One of the things that really resonated with me that Rebecca said was about the kind of the focus in our society on results. And it seems like that a grace-centered theology can't focus on results, because as one of the patron saints of Holden Village, Gertrude Lundholm, says, we all fail. In the end, we all fail. And so we rely on a God who loves us in the places where we fail, as well as in the places where we feel like, boy, we just hit it on the head and really did it well. Because that happens less often for me.
In the time, I failed to read the next sentence, which is, as for big results, they are not in your hands or mine, and they can't happen.
Yeah. Well, in your question, how can we do this, it just brings us back to all these things we are doing, the writing and the poetry and the art, the visual art and the movement and the dance and the music. I mean, you think of how rich our music is, how many artists out there are putting the word into song and how effective that is.
Raising children.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think part of it too has to do with finding something that you have a passion for, that gives you meaning, that you can do. For me, that's music, but I was thinking, as you were talking about that, about a story a friend of mine who's a consultant tells about a fellow who runs a dog food factory. And when he interviewed this person, he was amazed at how thrilled this person, excited he was about what he did. Huh. And he's trying to figure out why. And he got the person telling the story. He started telling the story and talking about, you know, cities are big and they're so impersonal. People have so little in their lives that a pet can be such a way into people's lives, a way for them to express themselves. And the fact that we produce this so that people can have pets. Mm-hmm. And it's like, he had this whole story. That, you know, didn't have to rehearse it. It was all there, and it was how he found meaning. And whether you're building a house, making dog food, playing a song, playing a poem, I think it's the passion, it's the meaning that makes it creative. Mm-hmm. Or it can be as dull as, you know, old cheese.
And I think we have too narrow a view of art in our society, like you were saying. We tend to view it as just these certain things, where it can be our whole life. And also, you don't have to create something to be an artist. Like, I can't create music, but I experience it. Some other people may say, well, I can't do art, but you go through a gallery, you experience it. So you're still involved in the creative process. Don't narrow things so down so far.
Boy, that is so true. When I think about performing music, it's just so incredibly obvious after, you know, a certain number of years, that if there weren't people who didn't play sitting in the audience that really gave that energy back so that there was a circular motion, it you know, it would be a bunch of prima donnas sitting around going, now let me sing. You know, and I've seen that happen before, you know, and there's an incredible beauty, really, because especially people that do it a lot or do it in front of people, you know, whether it's poetry readings or dance or anything, there is this sense that the more people respond to what you do, the more humility you have about how can I be given this great gift of people who want to hear what I have to do. And I don't know if I'm explaining that very well, but there's just a real beauty in that kind of receptiveness that is a huge gift to people who do, you know, art more out there, you know.
We have to complete the circuit.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, right, the idea that it's a community thing and that you are giving and taking and that just goes on and on and on in ways you don't know. And teaching, they always say that. You don't know which lecture, you know, catches somebody who goes off and lives their lives differently because of that. And I'm always very moved by that aspect of creativity, I suppose. I wouldn't have gone to study poetry, I don't think. I had always written in journals, but very privately, never showed it to anybody. Poems, I don't know, everything. But I was going to go work for a publishing company after I graduated because I had an English major, and that's what I thought I could do. But I was bored after a couple of years of just sort of doing what I had to do and making money, and I thought back to a book I'd read as a college student that was a book of poetry by a poet I'd never heard of before, but she was doing poetry of witness about things she'd seen in El Salvador, and it struck me, and it was years later, and I went off to study poetry. And, you know, I look back to that and think, well, I wonder what I would have done had I not had that book or read that book in a class, something else. But I'm living my life very differently because of that. And so I'm always very moved by, you know, what art can do or where it sends us.
I was just thinking, I'm one of those people that live in the city, and I have a job. It's pretty satisfying, but, you know, every once in a while I get this feeling like there's something missing. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I've been really, like, trying to find other things that really, like, you just feel like, oh, this gives me something alive here, or mm-hmm. or it reconnects you with yourself or something.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I like Holden here, because it always helps you kind of listen to yourself again and think, oh yeah, that's who I am.
Right. Yeah.
And also I was thinking in scripture there's a verse, I don't know where it is, but it's that we are created in the image of God and we are his children. So it's no wonder that we have those abilities even though we don't always believe in them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, if you've ever seen that book, The Artist's Way, which is sold here, it's just an excellent book. It's really about unblocking all those creative urges. And the woman, Julie Cameron, who wrote it, she talks about being a pipe directly, a channel directly from God. And your job is to unclog the channel, not to have the ideas. That if you can get out of the way, the art will come, the creativity, the grace, you know, all that will come. And that she says, you know, you need to post at your workstation a little sign that says, great creator, I'll take care of the quantity, you take care of the quality, which is basically, I'll sit down for an hour a day if you'll, you know.
Yeah.
That's
interesting.
I call it freedom to be me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's a great thing.
When I hear the word channel, I always think about Ramtha and that kind of New Age stuff.
Yeah.
But a couple of years ago, I was in a class on... I just graduated from seminary in Berkeley, and I was taking a class on Luther. And we spent the whole semester just reading the Large Catechism, which is partly why I know where stuff is in this kind of obscure book. But Luther talks exactly about that, about how we're channels for God's work in the world, how we're really extensions of God's hand, helping God to create and sustain the world. And he says creatures are only the hands. This is his warning to not think too much of ourselves. Creatures are only the hands, channels, and means through which God bestows all blessing. Now listen to his example. I think this is wonderful. For example, God gives the mother breasts and milk for her infant. So that's one way that we participate in God's care for creation, mothers giving nourishment to their children. And the second example is God gives grain and all kinds of fruit from the earth for the nourishment of people, which no creature could produce by themselves. So I love that image that somehow creating isn't just God's work, but we're participants our whole life through.
William Blake is a poet, when I think of channeling again. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was this exuberant, considered mad, you know, in his lifetime, but he would proclaim that he'd just written the most wonderful poem that had ever been written. And I read someone once saying he could get away with it because it had nothing to do with arrogance. He truly believed he was this vehicle for the Spirit. And so it was a matter of great joy that he had been chosen to write this down, but he wasn't taking credit for it. And his sense of himself as a writer really was to be receptive. And you know, I don't know if he considered that he was doing any manipulating or simply writing this down, but I always think that he had such exuberance in and utter curiosity, and he was you know, a dangerous thinker in some ways, I mean, very radical, and but utterly committed to him.
Gee, please. Yeah, it's reminding me that just a part of the syntax of ancient Japan, which persists, but and saying ancient Japan relevant to, therefore, it was in ancient China first, but is the metaphor of the poet being the pipe, the poet being, in other words, the flute, and God being, or inspiration, or however one would speak about it in whichever culture, being the breath across the flute.
Yeah.
And I really think that, especially for Midwestern Lutheran people or whatever, a lot of religious people in general, I think that that's that freedom to be me, because so often we're told, you know, don't show off, don't stick mm-hmm. out, you know, who, I mean, the best one is, you know, who do you think you are? Well, and I think that people go through life and, I mean, nobody's even had to say that to me for 25 years because it's in my head. Every time I think I'm going to do this, there's this little voice that goes, who do you think you are? You know, but if we could really embrace that idea of who do I think I am, I'm a conduit for God's creativity. I'm made in the image of God, and God's image is creator. Therefore, I'm a co-creator. And if I could just step out of the way, I would say, who do I think I am now? I'm a child of God. Back up, you know? I mean,
who the heck do you think you are?
Yeah, exactly. Well, and you know, in this book, Julia Cameron writes, you know, how dare you not? You know, how dare you say I'm not going to create because I'm not worthy? Mm-hmm. You know, how dare you? Because you know, you're given this one life, and you're the only you that'll ever be on earth. You know.
That's right.
It's not easy, though. I'm kind of embarrassed saying this in front of my husband because he knows, like, how bad I am at doing these things.
Well, I realize, too, even in introducing myself, it's much easier for me to say I'm a teacher. I teach poetry than to say I'm a poet. Mm-hmm. I write poetry. Yeah. I mean, it's really hard for me. I can hardly say it, you know, And I was very, very private about it for a long time until I went to study with this professor who said, you've got a responsibility. You know, what are you doing keeping all this in your little notebooks where nobody ever sees it? You know, except for you. Who do you think you are?
There you go. But,
that's true. Please.
Looking at it, just a little bit of a turn, I think that particularly the Old Testament, but it's, you know, reinforced certainly in the New Testament, that God's people were very unimaginative most of the time. And that's when they got in trouble with God. Mm-hmm. Like when they followed what their neighbors did. Mm-hmm. oh, let's worship idols. They're doing it, you know.
Yeah.
You know, keep up with the Joneses kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think to even claim that we believe in a God that we cannot produce takes imagination.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that it comes from us. Again, I agree with the conduit idea of if we will be open, God will give us this with His Spirit, you know, and teach us about these things. Even the disciples, every time they sound really silly, you know, they're not being open. What do you mean by that parable, Jesus? That doesn't make any sense. Because we had the commentary all the way along, you know, so we can feel a little, you know, smug about that. But if we were to be hit with something like that, you know, we'd be saying, well, what do you mean? You know, how can I be born again? Do I have to go back into my mother's womb?
Right.
You know, I mean, to us we go, oh, wasn't he naive? Well, you know, we're so great because we understand it. But I think that the whole history of God's people has been just keep your nose to the grindstone, you know, don't look up, don't do all these things. And God is saying, please be creative, be imaginative. Imagine me. What do I look like?
Mm-hmm.
I'm a spirit. What do I look like?
No.
You know, that's why I said Jesus, because I couldn't figure out what God looked like. You know, I said, here. and I'm not saying that's, you know, that God has to look anthropomorphic. I'm just saying that because we were human, He had to send Jesus because we could not imagine. And I think that we still have a lot of trouble imagining who and what and how is the Holy Spirit. And I think that's one reason we have trouble being open to the Holy Spirit is because it's pretty foreign to a lot of us. We don't know what to say about the Holy Spirit, except the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. You know, just kind of a tag on the end. But as far as being risky or, you know, being a fool for Christ and saying, yes, the Spirit is working in me, you know, and not to have to kind of crawl under the chair and say, but I'm not a charismatic or, you know, but I'm not this or, you know, they were drawing their lines again, you know.
Disclaimers,
right, you know. I just feel like there are many ways that we're not exploring. You know, a prime example for me is that in the Bible it talks about you sing songs, hymns, and spiritual songs. And we have fights in churches over what are we going to sing more of, you know. Well, you know, this group of Protestants, they sing songs. Well, you know, the German Lutherans sing hymns, you know. and as far as spiritual songs, well, that was the African-American heritage, you know. And what we need to do is incorporate all kinds, not just say we can only do this kind of music, you know, that this is better than this. Mm-hmm. And the same way with dance, you know. Mm-hmm. How, you know, who are we to say that one dance style is so much superior to another just because it happens to be in right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Jews were always dancing to God.
Yeah.
You know, and they weren't doing special little steps all the time. I mean, yes, you have the hamna or nida, you know, you do your special step, but there were lots of times they were just dancing for joy,
yeah.
You know. Mm-hmm. When the Ten Commandments came down, Miriam led all these, you know, people with dancing, you know, and it's just so hard for us to imagine that. You know, we're getting where we can move around a little bit, you know, in our service. We're getting there, but it doesn't mean we have to reject our heritage. You know, we don't have to always do that. Sometimes we can sit very still, be very quiet, and still worship God and receive the Spirit, etc.
Those of us who read the words of George Santayana nearly three generations ago resented the words because the word imagination sounds like something unreal.
Huh.
And therefore, his words were these: religion is always dependent upon imagination. But that's not necessarily bad.
Yeah.
Well, somebody said that in Larry's talk today, he quoted the Alice Walker passage from the Color Purple, where yeah. God's pissed off if you don't notice the color purple in the field. Yeah. And, you know, that's, I think, what you were saying about we get in trouble when we're closed off to that. And it seems to me we're most closed off to it during the sort of center part of our lives. Kids are very imaginative, very exuberant, very forthcoming. You know, they've got their imaginary friends, and they, you know, I've never had such an easy time teaching poetry as to little kids, and they will burst into dance, and they will. And I think, actually, my experience with elderly people is that, for the most part, my grandmothers and my grandfather, on the other end, we're also more free, and somehow here in the middle, we're really locked into how to behave. And what a waste. You know, I wrote down today, just because I was reading, and I came across this quotation by Muriel Rukeyser, who was an American poet, and it just struck me as interesting thinking about tonight. Growth is the security of organic life. The security of the imagination lies in calling all our lives for more liberty, more rebellion, more belief. Huh. And that struck me as being very parallel to Jesus and these teachings, I think. Huh. The security of the imagination.
I think along this idea of our narrowing ourselves, back to what you were saying, in my workshop, we do a little word study. And in Hebrew, there are 13 different words that mean dance. Processing, praise to God, spinning around, jumping for joy, all these things. And by the time the Bible was translated into Greek, Greek only had 5 words for dance. Because the number of words in a culture shows how important an item is to that culture. Like the Eskimos have so many words for snow. And then we get to English and we've only got one. You know, like this narrowing of our view of life. And like you said, Jesus was born into a dancing culture. Our Lord must have danced. It was the only way to get to the wedding at Cana. Everyone danced there. Every passage of life was celebrated, and they were probably not set dances, you know, where you do this move and that move. They were most likely a more improvisational thing.
And she just said King David too.
Yes, dance before the Lord. And we can translate that and take it all the way back to Hebrew and find out exactly what David was doing. Was he leaping for joy or was he spinning around? I have all those words in my workshop. So maybe it's our culture, maybe it's our age, maybe it's our heritage. Maybe it's because we moved north, I don't know.
Yeah, really, that's
something has caused us to narrow ourselves, especially in the creative, and to say, oh, this person is an artist and this person is a poet, and not continually strive to find what is in ourself, whether we appreciate or... And I think any point along the creative process that you are, you're being creative. You know, you don't have to be producing it yourself. You mean listening to it and becoming involved that way, or thinking about it, or causing you, or reading about it, or...
You were going to say something.
Yeah, I was going to say, I just had a flash. I was thinking, when I was in grade school and... you know, going through, you know, the upper grades as well, I was thinking, I always kind of discounted my creativity, and I thought, well, but how are you going to get out in the world? I mean, you can't live on doing this, so I kind of repressed it, yeah. I think. Mm-hmm. But now I think I'm finally letting it start to, you know, come up again. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of people do that just in our society, way that they just, they beat it out of you in the school system.
Yeah, because you have to get a job. I mean, students will say, what classes do I take to get a job? Mm-hmm. And they know if they go home at Christmas and say, I'm taking poetry, parents are going to go,
A lot of people in our generation, too, are children of the Depression.
Messages to say, you can't make a living doing it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My father, not that long ago, said, Linda, music is an avocation. You know, it's great that you do it, but, you know.
Get a real job.
So, I think that.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. something to fall back on.
Yeah.
I also just want to say, it makes me really sad to think about how there appears in many congregations to be a lack of richness around creativity, mm-hmm. and to hear Roxanne say that she didn't feel she fit in church because of her creativity. There's something wrong with that.
I think some of it, at least my intuition about that, is a connection the physical or the body, that church is very, or has been in my experience, very suspicious of anything that, would burst into song or start, dancing, showing your body, singing, that kind of thing. And I think that was my sense as a kid, that, then I'd rather be out in the field barefoot and dancing than sort of quietly sitting in the pew and hoping I didn't talk too loud or, So I think, that that's not ultimately right. That's not what we intend, I don't think, but it seems to happen.
I think that there are some people who are really, I'm over here, I just thought I was joking, who are really uncomfortable when you kind of go out of what's expected.
Yeah.
Like on Sunday morning. I mean, I have a really good friend who sometimes will just stop coming to church if some Sunday we kind of go out of, out of what we ordinarily do, and maybe like, hug somebody next to us. I mean, she's just like very comfortable with that. She's a neat lady, but that's not what she comes to church to do.
There's something safe about what's familiar.
Yes.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is fear. It's that fear of I think a lot of people have a lot of grief about their bodies, mm-hmm. that they don't even know about, really there's something that if you don't think about it that just feels so good about movement, mm-hmm. that they're so afraid. I don't know how to even say it. There's just grief because they think if I move that way, I would realize how much I have lost my whole life or how held back I am. And I think you just have to go really gently, But do it. You have to do it.
Right.
So is somebody else who wanted to?
Yes, over there. I'm down to hear.
This addresses a lot of Christianity has been used recently to really attack the arts. Mm-hmm. In a big way, arts have taken a huge hit recently. And it seems to be, all the arts have taken a hit. Mm-hmm. But it began mostly as an assault against artists sort of expressing, gay artists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, physicality.
Expressing issues around homosexuality or sexuality in general. So mm-hmm. a huge hit. I was just interested to hear if you feel there's any tension between art and the church.
Well, I'd like to make a plug for a book in the bookstore. Well, this, they say plug the books that you teach in your class, and since I'm not teaching my class, there is a book up there written by these Cynthia Winton Henry and Phil Porter. It's called Body and Soul, and I forget the subtitle, but it's something like Explorations into Physicality and Spirituality. And Cynthia Winton Henry started her life as a dancer and became a minister because that was so important to her, and eventually had to leave the church because she said, I have to do this and they won't let me. And so now, 10 years later, she's being invited back into all these churches because people know they need that. But it's a whole huge historical thing that goes way, 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 way back, but not back to the beginning. I think at the beginning, bodies were beautiful, and movement was you know, and there wasn't that mind-body-spirit split.
And I think it's no surprise that in countries where there's repression, some of the first people to be put in jail are the artists and the poets. Mm-hmm. So I think there's real tension between the creative folks and the people who want to keep order. And oftentimes churches are the first ones that want to keep order for many reasons, partly because they're nervous they'll lose their tradition, they'll lose their history. Mm-hmm. But we've gone for about an hour, and I want to both say that to respect people's time we should stop, but that doesn't mean that the conversation stops, and I feel like it's been a very fruitful conversation, and I hope that the conversation continues over coffee and on the trails and as we go about our lives here at Holden. So I thank the panel for sharing and everyone else for coming and for sharing in the discussion.
Thank you.